Welcome to this edition of Family Voices, a segment of AUSA's Army Matters podcast. Thank you for joining us. My name is Patty Barron, AUSA's Director of Family Readiness. Today, my colleague, Mr. Mark Hallin, AUSA's Director of Government Affairs, will co-host as we speak with our guests from the Defense Health Agency about changes to the military health system.
Thank you, Patty. Today, we are honored to be with two senior leaders in the Defense Health Agency. Lieutenant General Ronald Place, who is the Director of the Defense Health Agency, and Command Sergeant Major Michael Gregg, who is the Senior Enlisted Leader for the Defense Health Agency. Gentlemen, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And to provide a little more of an introduction for our two guests, Lieutenant General Place is a U.S. Army medical doctor and surgeon, and he leads the Defense Health Agency, which ensures the medical readiness of our nation's armed forces, the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force. DHA also provides quality healthcare services for our military families, retirees, and other beneficiaries. Command Sergeant Major Gregg is a combat medic who has led soldiers in tactical units and at major medical centers worldwide, Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and the United States. General Place, in early March, you kindly met with us and provided an update on the military health system. Our discussion was most informative and helpful for our Army service members and their families. So thank you very much for returning to continue the discussion. And when we had our first podcast with you, the nation was in the initial stages of COVID-19. And about 2 weeks from that podcast, life really changed for all of us. We began working remotely in social distancing, wearing face masks, and much, much more. Teleeducation, telemedicine have really become common practices and accepted as the norm versus done by exception. The military health system has provided doctors, specialists, and staff throughout our country in response to COVID-19, responding to the nation's call for help to defeat the pandemic. AUSA is indeed grateful for all you and the thousands of military medical professionals, regular guard and reserve, have done and continue to do in fighting this deadly disease, to include the important research to find a vaccine cure. Thank you, sir, for your leadership over all of this. So as the Department of Defense remains in a bitter fight to save our nation from COVID-19, would you both please update our Army service members and their families on the status of the military health system and perhaps include the status of the military treatment facilities and available care and services?
Sure. So the guidance that we've received from the Secretary of Defense is the same guidance that you've likely seen or heard. And it's really threefold. The first of which is, are we protecting our people? So are we doing everything we can to keep them safe? That's our force, our uniformed force, our families, and all our patients' beneficiaries. Things that we've done to do that are force health projections, social distancing, face masks, cloth masks, et cetera. Second is, how do we maintain the readiness of the force? Some of that is through a testing strategy to make sure that those who are infected can be quarantined, isolated away from others so that those who are still in their job or not infected continue to be accessed into the force to go through basic training, to maintain their training, individual level trainings, large unit trainings, et cetera. And then finally, how can we support the whole of government efforts? Those are largely being done by the services themselves. So as the Army or the Navy, the Air Force, Marine Corps have put service members in communities to help them out, the Defense Health Agency is in support of that with manpower, material, logistics, those sorts of things. So that's the overarching factors. But then from a status perspective, what are we doing about that? So in large part, we've looked at what are the strengths of the military health system. Part of that's analytics. We do a pretty good job of seeing what does a future conflict look like, and then how do we do modeling for the resources that are necessary for that conflict? This particular conflict happens to be a biological conflict against the virus, but the expertise that exists in the department to be able to model what does the virus look like, where is there expansion of requirements for it, how do we get the right logistics to support whatever's happening in those areas, I think we've done a lot of that. Part of it's from a testing strategy. So from what we had from a testing capability back when we first talked in the late winter, to now, at that point, we had 15 labs who could do COVID-type testing. As of yesterday, it was 126 labs who could do COVID-type testing. So where can we get the right locations to do those first three priorities that I talked about? How can we put it in the right places, in the right hands, with the right capabilities to maintain those three lines of effort? We've also looked at how can we provide services? So we're used to face-to-face services. How can we transition to keeping people safe, right? The first priority, how can we protect the people? So where does telehealth fit into that? And if there are rules or regulations that are preventing some of that, how can we modify or how can we put additional or change the regulations such that they provide quality and safety and all those sorts of things, but still allow healthcare to be delivered in an asynchronous environment where it's not face-to-face anymore? And then based on those telehealth, how can we then send some of that capability to the managed care support contractor? So TRICARE's overseas partner are the two managed care support contractors that we have here that enable healthcare to happen in our outside the installation clinics or hospitals. And what rules were preventing that from happening from the use of telehealth? All those are ways that we've changed systems to enable the ongoing access to high quality, safe care. And then finally, how can we use the entirety of the military health system to bring data in and then look at that data to determine what's the best way to take care of people who are sick with this particular virus? Is the right way to put them in the hospital or not put them in the hospital? Is the right way to give them this pill or this treatment or this medication or not anything? Is it to give them oxygen or whatever it is? And so utilizing all the information from the way that we're caring for them and then writing a practice management guideline. In other words, this is the way that we're going to provide care to everyone. This is a good skeleton of the things that we should be looking for and the modalities that we should be considering when we have someone who's sick. And then when some of that modality involves something we can generate it ourselves, like COVID convalescent plasma, the blood products that have been looked at across America for, is this a modality to do it? We can use all of our blood donor centers throughout the Department of Defense to generate more of that COVID convalescent plasma to be able to treat them. And then fundamentally, then take all of that information and put it in a thing that we call a registry, which is a way of looking at all of the demographics of a particular patient, their age, their race, their other medical problems, their symptoms, what medications they've had, whether they had to be admitted or not, if they needed any procedures, those sorts of things, and then use that information as a continuous process improvement to always make sure we're on the forefront of what's best for our patients. That's what we've been doing about COVID since last we chatted.
General Place and Sergeant Major Gregg, that's just unbelievable how much you have done in such a short period of time. Really, it's incredible. And given all the challenges that COVID-19 is placing upon us, the Defense Department has also been directed through legislation to consolidate the military treatment facilities and reduce the numbers of military medical positions. I know this is one of your favorite topics, sir. We are amazed and really indeed grateful for how you and your leadership team are so effectively fighting COVID-19 while still providing the needed medical and healthcare support for our military service members, families, and retirees throughout the entire world. So could you please provide us with an update on the reform initiatives, which, as I understand, are on hold, that the Congress is taking an interest in this as well, and that the Defense Secretary has asked to reverse the consolidations of the MTF. So any updates you can provide us right now would be very helpful because it's kind of cloudy at the moment.
Sure, Patty. So this is an incredibly complex topic, so I'm glad that you asked the question. There's essentially three main reform efforts. The first of those reform efforts is the management of our hospitals, our clinics, and our medical centers. And the letter, a memo that you're mentioning really dives into that. And the idea, at least as I understand the memo, is the Congress and the department have put us on a pathway to optimize the effective delivery of healthcare within our system. And that system should provide for a ready medical force. In other words, every service member from a medical perspective is optimally ready to do their job anywhere and everywhere the department asks them to do it. Job one. Also, a ready medical force. So that means the department must provide hospitals, clinics, medical centers, et cetera, such that our staff can both obtain and maintain the currency and competency of the medical expertise that we expect out of them, both here in America and anywhere around the world that we ask them to do it. And then finally, that it's integrated in such a way that it's both effective and efficient. And in order to maximize the efficiency, it's best first to be most effective at it. And so that's the lens with which we're looking at the reform of how should they be managed. I think that the leaders within the Department of Defense have said, well, let's look at the observations that we have based on this pandemic as an operation, because it is. And the enemy, instead of being a nation state or a nationless state of violent extremist organizations, it's a virus, which makes it a biological agent. We are fighting a war against a biological agent. And are there lessons then? Are there observations that we can take based on what this particular adversary, this biological adversary, and does it give us information then to reshape, reform, provide more information into the transition of the leadership of those hospitals, those clinics, and those medical centers? And that process is ongoing. There's been hundreds of observations, and collectively as a military health system, and even larger than that, collectively as a Department of Defense then, the department is then looking at all that, and my belief is that the current pathway will be changed from it. What exactly the next phase or the next change looks like, I don't think any of us know yet, but we're all collectively in agreement that we must learn what we can from the mission to contact against this particular adversary to get better. That's the first reform effort. The second reform effort is what we would call Section 703 of the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act, and that is to have the right number and amount of medical centers, hospitals, and clinics. That's a report that was sent over to the Congress earlier this year. I think it was in February, but I may have the exact month wrong. But it looked at those same three things. What facilities do we need to both maintain that force, so a medically ready force? What facilities do we need as platforms for obtaining and sustaining the currency and competency of our uniform medical force? And assuming all those things are true and we still have more excess capacity than that, in those particular locations, is healthcare available with good access, good quality, good safe care outside the installation? If all those things can be met, then we probably don't need the infrastructure associated with it. And then what decisions can be made? We talked about that a little bit the last time I was on, but COVID has impacted that. All businesses in America have been impacted by COVID, and the healthcare industry is no different. So what was true last fall or what was true in the wintertime isn't necessarily true anymore. Hospitals have had financial challenges. Some have closed. Outpatient medical offices have had businesses challenges, and some of them have closed. So our responsibility now is to relook at what we thought was capacity or capability we could partner with offside the installation. Is that still true? If not, can we negotiate? Can we contract? Can we work with installation entities to build that if, in fact, we don't need that capacity? But even if it's excess capacity, but it can't be developed or isn't present outside the installation, then my responsibility is to go back to the department and provide that information. And do we need to rethink that arm of the reform process? And then the third arm of the reform process, do we have the right number and the right kinds of military medical specialties? Do we have the right numbers of doctors and doctor specialties? Do we have the right number of nurses and nurse specialties? Do we have the right number and types of medic specialties, enlisted specialties? Again, the feedback that we're all providing, the department is looking at in terms of, has this adversary, this pandemic adversary, has it taught us anything that we didn't know before? Does it make us change our opinions about the risks or advantages or disadvantages of the number and types of medical specialties that we have within our force? All that's happening right now within the department. And as we get more information on it, that feedback will be given and decisions will be made by senior leaders within the division or within the department. And the good news that I have for you is both from the DHA and from the service surgeon generals, our voices are being heard. The information that we're delivering is being questioned with very careful questions. And ultimately, the decision-making of the department will reflect that information as we go forward from this pandemic. I hope that answers your question.
Sir, that is a great answer, mainly because I am also hearing what you're saying. You're taking it all in. You're seeing how COVID-19 has impacted not only the day-to-day mission, but just the overall mission of the department and the Defense Health Agency, and ultimately is how do we take good care of our people? And I know that we're in good hands with you. I feel that very, very strongly. Also, with so many other incredible military medical professionals that are the heroes that continue to fight COVID-19, whether they be in the hospital setting, in a clinic setting, but certainly there have been an awful lot of heroes in the research setting. And so we're wondering if you can update our listeners on how the research that is ongoing and the preparations that are being made to manufacture and distribute a vaccine are progressing. And Sergeant Major, would you then please tell us how the enlisted medical staff are also supporting this really important national effort?
So from the Operation Warp Speed, I am truly impressed with the both dedication and expertise of the biomedical staff around the country who are working in this. I have never seen the speed with which a vaccine has been developed. Now, we're not there yet, so I don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse, but this is truly amazing work. And I'm glad we're talking about vaccines to start with. Patty, I know that you've dedicated time and effort to facilitating the understanding of the importance of vaccines for our service members and their families, but most importantly, a very vulnerable part of our families, and that is our children. So in addition to this particular vaccine, the fact that you've highlighted that we need to maintain vaccines for all of those vaccination products, I really can't thank you enough for it. But to go back to the COVID vaccine, the development is proceeding at an extraordinary pace. There are several really high-performing vaccines that are in the right phases of clinical trials, phase two and phase three of their clinical trials, to make sure that they're safe and that they're effective. And if one or more of these vaccines, both here or if one of our allies or partners develops a similar vaccine that, again, they can show is safe and effective, then we'll turn that into the rest of the enterprise for manufacturing it. And the federal government is making extraordinary investments. The DoD is part of that investment into manufacturing truly hundreds of millions of doses. Some of those doses, right, millions of those doses would be within the Department of Defense. And then we don't necessarily know what responsibilities the DoD will have for distribution, but we do know that we'll have responsibility for distribution within the Department of Defense. And then developing a plan for the rapid inoculation of our DoD beneficiaries has already been given to us as a responsibility. Preliminary plans have already been drafted. Some of it will be dependent upon the type of vaccine. Is it a shot, for example, or is it like some of the influenza vaccines that are inhaled into the nose? Is it a single vaccination or is it multiple vaccinations? Will we have to check a titer? In other words, we're going to have to check for blood levels to determine do you need more or not. All those things have yet to be determined based on the vaccine that's developed. But we've developed contingency plans already for each of those different kinds of vaccinations to be able to deliver them either later this year or next year, depending on when those vaccines are developed. Sergeant Major, more comments?
So, yes, Ms. Patty. So, you know, as always, the enlisted force is there augmenting the reality of all of our licensed doctors and nurses. So the number of laboratory technicians and medics out there and respiratory therapists who have been performing these thousands of tests, who have been working on all of these patients, whether in our MTFs, in our military treatment facilities, or in the hospitals of New York City and Houston and Seattle, they've just been phenomenal in showing the skill set and professionalism of the enlisted corps across the enterprise. So as always, the strength of our nation and the strength of our Army is on the back of an enlisted soldier who is ensuring that everything is going well.
General Place and Sergeant Major Gregg, it is indeed heartwarming to learn about the accomplishments of our military medical professionals who are working in the hospitals, in the research centers, and in other ways throughout our country. This must really uplift you and energize you both as senior medical leaders in the Defense Department. So, General Place, looking forward to the remainder of the year and into 2021, COVID-19 notwithstanding, can you share with us any new and upcoming advances or improvements in the military health system that are particularly exciting to you and your leadership team?
I really appreciate this particular question. So the reform answer that I gave you before are ways that the Congress and the Department are looking at us to help us be the best organization that we can be. But there's another reform element that started several years ago, but it's not part of this part of the reform, and that is our electronic health record. The development and then implementation of this new electronic health record is ongoing. Now, it was put on pause for the last several months because of really all the energy being put into our response to COVID, but we have gone back to the business of our rollout of this new electronic health record. So first, what is it, this MHS Genesis? It's a commercial off-the-shelf electronic health record. The benefit to that is it was acquired using the department's normal acquisition practice, which means you set the requirements. This is what it must do. You give it out to industry, what exists out there, and that can best meet the needs of the Department of Defense, then we form a relationship with. In fact, that relationship was thought to be so strong that when the VA saw the benefits of having this particular electronic health record, they also signed on for it. So which further validates from a federal system, this electronic health record from the time you're born to the time that you're a retiree with decades using the system, we should be on the same electronic health record. Now, we're still relatively early in the implementation. You'll likely recall that there was an initial operating site in the Pacific Northwest, and that's almost 3 years ago now that we started that process. We believed that we had a good system. We believed that we had a good process. We thought that we're going to take a little bit of a pause, learn a little bit about it, and then do the next waves. What we found, on the other hand, was that we grossly underestimated the challenges associated with rolling out a new electronic health record. And I won't get into details of what we underestimated, but they were all found using an after-action report. And so those issues were found, the trouble tickets, to talk the language of the technical people, were identified, the fixes were put in place. It took months to be able to do. And then we went back into the rolling out of the waves. Now, last year about this time, the first waves, after the initial operating sites happened, we went to those waves, and what we found was, hey, we're much better at this now. Not perfect, still much to learn, but not nearly the number of trouble tickets, not nearly the complexity of the trouble ticket. And in general, the staff were very pleased with it, rapidly learning it, saying, yes, after I got through the very fast learning phase, this system works better for me. I believe this system delivers higher quality. I believe this system helps me maintain safe care for my patients. And so the fourth arm of the elements of significant change within the military health system is the continuing rollout of MHS Genesis, this new electronic health record. We're partnering with the Coast Guard. So yet this month, it'll be rolled out in the Coast Guard. Next month, we'll get back into it with our military health systems. Wave Nellis is our next system. So at Nellis Air Force Base out in the Las Vegas area is the next, and we'll keep on rolling with delivering this wonderful tool to support our caregivers so that they can provide great access to high quality safe care.
So your question is a great question, but my answer is probably not the answer that you were looking for. And so when I say, what am I most excited about? I'm most excited about the ability for the rest of the world to see the skill set, the bravery, and the leadership of the enlisted personnel, and to change the perception, not of all of the medics, but in particularly our low density, high technical individuals who have shown that bravery beyond reproach. You know, our laboratory guys who are churning out thousands and thousands and thousands of tests every day to ensure that we find out and understand where the enemy is. Our respiratory therapists who are out there on the front line who are assisting with the development of innovative devices like the CAMIC that are saving lives and are being patented to be there in the future. To our medics who are showing their skill sets beyond just trauma, beyond the gunshot wound, but their ability to care and be empathetic and to be there to take care. And our nurses. So across the enlisted enterprise, the ability of our enlisted soldiers to show their professionalism and to show the rest of the military system that we're more than just patching a gunshot wound. We're more than just wrapping a sprained ankle, that we are everything that you need and more.
Well, General Place, thank you, sir, for explaining the electronic health records to us. And it's easy to foresee the potential these will bring for medical care going forward. And Sergeant Major Greg, thank you for highlighting just how proud you are and the great work of the enlisted staff in our medical treatment facilities. And this leads us right into a question that Patty would like to ask.
I love hearing about the talented NCO Corps and enlisted corps within the military health system, because I'm telling you, as an infantry wife many, many years ago, when I went to the local brigade clinic, many times I had my blood drawn by one of the medics at the company level who were practicing their skills and needed a warm body to do it on. And I was always a little bit hesitant, but they always did a great job. And you're right. There are so many amazing roles that are played by our NCO Corps. Can you tell us a little bit about what type of training and education goes into the junior enlisted service members so that they can grow professionally and even better support the MTFs and the medical readiness of our units?
Absolutely, ma'am. And I hope that my praise of the enlisted corps doesn't go too far over the top. But like I said, I am just super proud of the accomplishments of our enlisted members and how we are looking to invest in them more to understand how they augment our reality and they make the life of the soldier just that much more valuable. Because, you know, I've shared it with General Place and he'll tell you the same thing, that the life is saved by that medic and that person on the ground that first touches them. Our doctors and nurses are phenomenal at sustaining and maintaining and improving the life. But the life is saved by that first person who gets there. And those enlisted members are augmentations of our providers. So they are just phenomenal. As we move forward, it's also highlighted with our METSI, the Medical Education and Training Campus down in San Antonio, that a lot of our training that we have co-located is not as integrated as we'd like it to be. And that our POI development needs to be a continuous process as we continue to improve and update it so that we can be more versatile on the battlefield and actually assist in changing anything or any type of injury or death outcome by having the skill set and knowledge to affect that change. So at the METSI, we are constantly doing a revision. We have a summit coming up in January where we're going to look at integrating and improving our POI development across the services so that all the services will have a skill set that is similar, that as we pass along individuals from service to service in a hospital environment, because we're in a joint environment, you'll know exactly what you're getting when you see that sailor, soldier, or airman walk into your facility. You'll know their skill set, and we're building and working with USHUs to put an accreditation against every MOS so that those individuals will also have a marketable career after the military if they don't choose to stay in for 40 years, like we'd like them all to.
That's fantastic. That is really great. Mark?
Yes, thank you, Patty. And I'd like to echo Patty's comments, Sergeant Major. Thank you for highlighting the very important essential role for non-commissioned officers and enlisted medical staff within the medical treatment system. They perform such an essential role. Turning now to the topic of technology, and General Place, you've covered this a little bit already with regards to technology contributing to healthcare in the COVID-19 environment. Could you share with us your assessment on how telehealth and other technology options are working out, as well as what you foresee for them in the future? Please.
It's a great question because we've seen a fundamental shift of acceptance. And by that I mean, it would be rare for one of our visits to be anything other than in person before this pandemic. Rare. I mean, much less than 1% of our visits. And yet in primary care, in some areas, more than half of our visits are now telehealth. If you look at the behavioral health system, huge majority of our visits are now telehealth. And so the acceptance by the healthcare staff and acceptance by our patients has really, really changed based on the requirements for this particular pandemic. There's also been some rules that have changed, some of which I have control over as the director of the DHA, some of which are rules that the president impacted by the national emergency. So for example, audio-only visits. Rulemaking authority allowed me to be able to say that those visits in the TRICARE network that are audio-only now can be paid, which means that in the past, the providers would only get paid if they actually saw them in person, so they're very reluctant to do it. Well, now they can do them audio only, so it's enabling that to happen. When it comes to interstate care, the president has waived the licensing requirement, which allows us then to optimize the delivery of healthcare wherever the practitioners may be. Now, what we don't know, these are just two examples, what we don't know is the efficacy of them. So is the efficacy of the audio only visit, what's the clinical outcome? Is it the same or is it better or is it not as good? From the crossing of state lines, do we still have the ability to monitor the clinical effectiveness as the care crosses state lines? If the answer to that is yes and the quality is still the same, does it still make sense to have that in place or could it be perpetually waived? So our responsibility now is to take information, to gather data about the outcomes of these changes of telehealth, and then making decisions, either ones that we can make ourselves or ones that we can advocate for changes for after the national emergency is over. Ultimately, though, there's two kinds of feedback that matter. One of them I already mentioned, the clinical outcome. But the second is from the patient's reported outcome. Are they okay long-term with this delivery of healthcare? Because if they're satisfied with it, if they get out of it what they want, and if they believe their health needs are being addressed by this particular modality, that's an important factor that goes into how we make decisions. So I want to make sure that you're understanding that I'm balancing both of them. What's the clinical effectiveness of it? What's the patient-reported effectiveness of it? How can we bring both of those together and then use that for decision-making as we go forward?
Sir, thank you very much for explaining that.
So much complicated decisions to be made, for sure.
For sure.
And sir, we're getting close to the end of our time, so I'm going to combine these two questions just a little bit for you. One is about the Exceptional Family Member Program, and the other is about the recompete contract process. The last time we talked, we did talk about EFMP and the Armed Services Committee wanting to support standardization of care within and between the military services. Wondering if you can update us on any plans for doing that. And then the other question that I had was about the TRICARE contract. Would you please update us on the status of the contract renewal and plans to recompete? For example, what do you foresee in the future as far as regions and consolidations go?
So, Patty, I think they are related questions. EFMP is service-led because these are service members. Our responsibility as a medical team, and in particular, our responsibility as the DHA, is in support of the services. So one of the areas that has garnered special attention to us is how can we decrease the anxiety that goes for EFMP members as they PCS from one location to another? As you recall, in general, the way that works is you start all over again. And you're on your own doing it. So how can we, when we know people are PCSing, not just how can we provide the information of what services are available at the next location a family PCSs to, but how can we enable, even if we cross the lines of the different managed care support contractor, how can we enable it such that they know who they're going to? And if appointments are necessary, those are even already set up before the PCS action opens. We've used an EFMP and Me program. It's just one example of how we can integrate with the individual service member and his or her family to enable that to happen. We don't believe that we have this nut completely cracked, so don't think this to mean that Oplace thinks he's got it all figured out, or Greg's the smartest guy in the room, therefore it's all going to be okay from here on out. We don't think that way. But we do believe that we are in support of the service personnel systems, and as we go forward with these programs, with the idea of the EFMP and Me program, with the idea that appointments can be set up before we ever PCS there, and then garner more feedback from our EFMP members. Is this working for you? Is it not working for you? What part did, what part didn't? What part could be better for you? We believe that we'll use a continuous process improvement to be able to get closer to perfect for that program. And that's really what it goes into the TRICARE program. Now, I'm confident that Sergeant Major is going to talk more about the EFMP, but let me use that also to answer the TRICARE question. We believe in this next generation TRICARE contract, we should be learning just like we are in the EFMP program. Some of that is learning from industry. Some of that's from learning within ourselves. So we're partnering with industry experts, with military service organizations and veteran service organizations to give us feedback and then write draft requests for proposals. In other words, this is what we think the contract might look like. Send that out to industry and say, what do you think about it? With the idea that the next generation contracts should do better than this current generation of contracts, such as how can we put into the contract best case telehealth? So that gets to the question answered before. How do we optimize choice for our beneficiaries where choice is important to them? How do we best measure both internal to our system as well as within the TRICARE contract, the quality and safety of care that's being delivered both in an inpatient system and in an outpatient system? And finally, how do we optimize the readiness of the force, both for the readiness of the medical readiness of the force? Every service member is medically ready for their job. And is that something that we measure when people go out into the civilian sector? As well as how do we make the right clinical conditions come into our medical centers, our hospitals, and our clinics to, again, obtain and sustain the currency and competency required to have that medical force go to the field? So they're kind of interrelated, but that's how the next generation TRICARE contracts are looking. Sergeant Major, over to you.
So, Ms. Patty, I was going to add to is that DHA is closely tied with Army Medicine and Office of the Surgeon General to ensure that we are working through the EFMP challenges that are facing the Army. And so with that said, we are going to be present at the AFAP-GOSC or the Army Family Action Plan General Officer Steering Committee next week at the Pentagon to ensure that we are tied at the hip to solve any of the challenges that EFMP will continue to present to the Army, that they know we care and that we are engaged.
Thank you both so much. One quick additional question, and that's about the enrollment fees. People will have to have, under 65, are going to have to pay an enrollment fee for TRICARE Select, I think. So if I have that wrong, I'd love for you to clarify that for me.
So you're right. So starting January 1st of this year, but with an enrollment timeline that starts in November of this year, for those members who are TRICARE Select. So in other words, they're not yet 65 and they are not TRICARE Prime. If they want to continue to use our system, then they must enroll into the TRICARE Select system. That open season again this fall. The fees are $150 a year, $1,250 a month for an individual, so an individual retiree, or $300 a year, $25 a month for a whole family to be able to continue in the TRICARE Select program. We think it's critically important that your listeners understand this. If they're not enrolled to the system, they won't be able to access our system. Now, we're going to blitz every communication strategy that we can think of, to include your podcast, of course, but information to military service organizations, information to veteran service organizations, information in text messages, robocalls, you name the system, we're flooding it to try to get people to know that it's no longer, it doesn't matter if I register, that's not the case anymore. If you're not registered, if you're not enrolled in our system, then you won't be part of our system and we don't want anybody left out. So if anything you can do to help us get that particular bit of information out to, again, it's Group A retirees, which means those people who came into the Department of Defense before 2018, that's who we're talking about. But those retirees under the age of 65, still within that, they must take action to maintain their ability to utilize the military health system.
Sir, thank you very much for going through the TRICARE Select enrollment fees with us. Understanding the background and knowing how much less the enrollment fees will be compared to the much larger amounts originally under consideration when the discussions occurred in 2016 is most helpful. General Place and Sergeant Major Gregg, we thank you so much for this very interesting and helpful and insightful discussion on the military medical health system today. So any final comments and remarks as we begin to conclude our podcast?
I can never stop bragging on the enlisted corps enough. And the one thing that I failed to speak on earlier was the SMART program that is being exercised within Army Medicine, that we have building programs within each of the medical services as well. And that program stands for the Strategic Medical Asset Readiness Training Program, which sets a MIL-CIF partnership that allows us to send our medical professionals, whether they're officers and doctors and nurses or are enlisted professionals, into the civilian facilities that have high trauma, high acuity cases, to allow our individuals to get the reps and the sets they need to maintain their skill set. So we are doing a phenomenal job of supporting the Army as they lead for soldiers and getting them into these facilities. And they have programs set up in Cincinnati, New Jersey, Portland, Oregon, and a couple of other places. But those are phenomenal programs that we are supporting them in any way we can to ensure they build readiness in the enlisted corps. Thank you.
Mark, Patty, thanks for having us on. Truly, I can't thank you enough for having the discussion. The most important people in the world to me are the 9.5 million beneficiaries that we have the privilege to be a part of their life. That's the most important thing that we do. And therefore, the most important people in the military health system, the most important people in the Defense Health Agency, are the folks who are in those exam rooms, those delivery suites, those operating rooms, those trauma bays, those logistic warehouses, the pulmonary function test clinic, wherever. Those are the most important people to us. And so our job is to find systems that enable them to deliver the highest quality care, the safest care, at the best access that we can possibly do. That's the whole mission. And so while I'm really proud of things that the agency has done to do that, we're fully committed to making incremental, or if need, or if we can, exponential improvements in how that support goes. So whether it's standardization of administrative processes such that it's easier for our patients to understand how our system works, we're interested in that. If that means utilizing clinical practice guidelines that improve the outcomes of every single member that we're privileged to care for, we're interested in that. If that means reviewing how it is that we interact with the service medical departments and the service surgeons, irrespective of who has the authority for it or who gets credit for it, we're interested in it. It doesn't matter to me how all this administrative stuff works, as long as it is in support of those frontline staff who mean the world to every single one of those 9.5 million beneficiaries. And so our ability to have this conversation with you is helpful for that, I think. but it pales in comparison to the pride that we have for what's happening at every clinic, every hospital, and every medical center. So we're thankful that you allow us to talk a little bit about what's happening. We're particularly thankful that you give us an opportunity to brag about the great staff who are getting it done, and we look forward to having another opportunity to talk with you a little bit more in the future. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Patty.
General Place, Sergeant Major Gregg, thank you so very much for joining us today for this very helpful and informative discussion on the military health system. And we at AUSA will do all we can to support you and to help soldiers and their families, retirees, and other beneficiaries to understand and have the best possible experience with the military health system. So again, we at AUSA thank you so very much for joining us today for this helpful discussion.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Hua.